So let's dive right in. What we're going to do today is we're going to see the principles behind inheritance, in the sense that we will try to have a focus on the most common systems out there. We'll have a look at how the most common principles behind there are working, like interface inheritance and implementation inheritance, and what that will mean for implementation consequences. We're going to have a look at the object heap layout for a language with implementation inheritance. In particular, we're going to have focus on how C++ is working under the hood, in the sense that we're going to have a look at the basics of how to organize heap or stack memory for objects. Going to have a look at how single inheritance is actually working. We're going to have a look at virtual methods. And then, step by step, we're going to extend that by the modifications that we have to do in order to implement inheritance with multiple parents, which will have severe consequences on the heap layout. So we're going to focus on multiple inheritance. We're going to have a look at what consequences are out there for resolving virtual methods, and the different notions of multiple parents in the sense of sharing or non-sharing of parents. And then we're going to discuss on the consequences of that. In between, we're going to have a look at alternatives to our study object C++, in the sense that there's languages out there that also have multiple inheritance but go a different path through the whole thing, in the sense that there's a kind of a prioritization of the particular parents. So if there's ambiguously provided function signatures in the particular parents, there's principles of how to resolve that with linearization. So we'll have a look at linearization algorithms essentially in this small excursion. So that's the program for inheritance and implementation of inheritance. So the general goal for which we aim here in that part of the lecture is now, of course, how to implement something like having several parents of your class, so how to derive your class from several base classes. That has to be seen in context of several different concepts. In particular, we have the concept of implementation inheritance and interface inheritance. So I've assembled a few of the principles that are behind that. So first of all, the implementation inheritance, since that is kind of the classical motivation of why we do inheritance at all. The selling point, so to say, for implementation inheritance is often code reusage. So implementation inheritance looks like you specify some base classes and then specify child classes that specialize these base classes, replacing only particular fragments of the base class with your own custom code, replacing the parts that are found in the base classes. So in that sense, the parents act like a library of already working code of most common behaviors, and you extend them with your own implementations in the parts where the common implementations and common behaviors don't fit into your personal scheme anymore. You'll find things like that as kind of the in languages like C++, Lisp, Smalltalk, even Java, all those mainstream languages. Then there's another notion of inheritance, which is the so-called interface inheritance, which is has kind of a different philosophy behind that. And that is the philosophy of the behavioral contract, you would call that. And in those approaches, the child class provides methods with signatures predetermined by the parent in the sense that you gather, when you implement your child class, a number of parent classes, which consist essentially in signatures, signatures only, and you in those approaches, the parents act as kind of blueprints of how code that has to be plugged in elsewhere should behave, in the sense that behavior is somehow a matter of the signatures of methods. So that is a kind of a that inverts the whole relation with inheritance here. You don't actually inherit concrete code with the purpose of code reusage, but you can use you, the code that you provide in several different areas in which you plug into, and languages in which you find such things stressed are more the ones like the Java and C++, where you have a lot of these interface hierarchies and all that. So to turn away from the purely purely theoretic ideas, examples for interface inheritance, you can see here. So that is somewhat familiar for the Java programmers, where you have these hierarchies of interfaces in your data structures, where you would have interfaces for queues that would just specify how a queue interacts with the rest of an algorithm, or how you can interact with the stack. And then you would go and assemble everything into a concrete class, for example, this class list here that would promise to fulfill the requirements for the interfaces, in the sense that it would then implement and offer the interfaces defined there. And in order not to duplicate any code in such environments, you often find arrangements like the one that I've sketched here, where you would then import the main code via aggregation instead of inheritance. So you would get your functionality from an implementation of, for example, a graph, which is essentially acting as a list, and the list would just forward the required interfaces to the actual implementation underneath the hood, and just offer the generic interface to the outside. So that is kind of one of the ideas of how to to have modules in your code. The other approach was the one with implementation inheritance, where you would simply just refer to your parent in terms of just obtaining implementations for certain methods. So if you model something like an aircraft carrier, you would be, for example, it would be possible to inherit same time from your ship model by referring to that. And so you would gain the toot your horn or to move to some place with a ship, and you would get some properties from the airport, for example, giving shelter to planes from the other parent, and you would just merge them into your own namespace and be able to use them from there. So that is the general idea of these two areas. So if you're trying to categorize the particular languages, Java is often mentioned as a language which would only have single inheritance. However, if you look more closely to that, you have to differentiate between these notions of implementation and interface inheritance, and it's actually a matter of your point of view of what you actually support. But yeah, for the purposes here, we will be going to develop a system starting from single inheritance and then extend it step by step to multiple inheritance, and we will focus on the implementation inheritance, as that is the more complex one to implement, actually. So that's what we're going to do. For that, we need to talk about how the different approaches can actually be implemented in terms of memory organization, in terms of how to lay out the representations for your classes, or the objects in the memory. And in order to do so quite concretely, we're going to have a look at certain implementation of C++ compiler, which is this LLVM. And that one offers a very, so to say, high-level intermediate representation with which you can express the high-level features of something like C++ on the low level without having to do typeless. So you can have things like types in there and have quite a generic collection of intermediate instructions which can be easily ported to particular concrete architectures. So that's why we're going to look at that. And I try to only focus on the parts of the LLVM IR that is actually important for the things like memory allocation and address computation, so you don't have to memorize too much of the complete intermediate representation, as that is quite quite a lot of instructions in there. However, you must say, comparing that, for example, to one of the smaller instruction sets like the PowerPC, this is quite close to that. So it's not one of the bigger assembly languages, but very concise, so to say. So that's what we're gonna focus on for for referring to what's actually gonna happen on the machine. So what's offered by the LLVM intermediate representation? You have the possibility to create kind of structs like the ones that you know from C as composed data structures, and you can nest those in each other in order to create your memory representation of choice. That's why we're focusing on that. So what you're going to find there is, for example, well, you will find things like these these terms that are starting with a percent sign, which are always supposed to be some kind of identifiers to which to refer to somewhere else in the code. So things like types also have an identifier as a handle. And yeah, with that we can define the type struct A by, and then it starts with type to show you that that's going to be interpreted as a type now. And as with structs, you have just the block brackets, and the components of that struct are now separated from each other with just the colons and the commas, and then you have the different components in there. And yeah, there's now these kind of constants which stand for certain data types. These are basic data types. This is an integer of 32 bits, starting with I and then the data width. You can also use other identifiers to nest your data structures into each other. So you can have a struct B typed part as the second component of struct A, and you can also represent things like pointers or function pointers, like this one here, where we have a function pointer of with a single parameter of type integer 32 bits, and it yields a return value of integer 32 bits. Yeah, and if we try to resolve what struct B actually means, it's also a struct where we have now a longer integer in there with 64 bits. We have a shorter integer with just 8 bits there, and we can also have things like arrays, which are these constructs over here, where we have a 10 times, 20 times integer 32-bit array there. So that's what you can do. You can nest these things as you like to use them. So that's the data types in there. Then you have things like allocation of memory, which comes from, well, you do an alloc A, which is sounds familiar if you have done a little bit of assembly programming. That's allocating a fragment of memory on the stack. Then the next thing is you somehow need to navigate within these things, within these memory areas. And the thing with LVMIR is that you can do so in by making use of the type structure that you have introduced with these types. So this get element pointer is actually sensitive to the type that you are going to navigate on. So in this case, we have a type for this first parameter A, and we interpret that as a pointer to struct A. And now the instruction get element pointer says that we start navigation on that thing. And now the question is, of course, where will we end with selecting components of that thing? And that is determined by the sequence of comma-separated expressions over there. In the, so they actually vary. Here, in that specific example, we only have two of these, a chain of length two here of navigational expressions, and they are interpreted as indices on that particular level of nesting. What does that mean in that case here? First of all, we have to interpret the first link in that chain, which is just a zero. So on the level of the pointer, we have a pointer of struct A. We're going to index the zeroth component of that. So that will kind of navigate from the pointer to the actual data structure itself. Then we have to interpret the next level of that chain, which says that we're indexing with 2 now. As we have seen that there is a 0 here, we can imagine that counting started with 0. So we will start counting from 0 to 2 in the actual type struct A, which will lead us to 0, 1, 2. So to the second component, which will be this one here within the struct A type. So that is what the navigation thing does. If we would have had another different expression, like having a 1 here, we could have continued with another constant and, for example, gone for a 0 here. Let's say that. What would that have done? That would have selected on the level of struct A this component, which would have been another struct that's inline there. So there we can continue a level deeper with another index, which would have left us with indexing 0 of component in there, which would have been this one. So I think you get the gist now. It's just this on the struct level you can nest, so you somehow need to be able to express a similar pattern on the navigational side. So this get element pointer is sensitive on the type on which you of the first parameter and interprets the list of indices on different levels of the data structure that you give it. So that's what the get element pointer is all about. Then you can have the actual load instruction, which will then fetch the value from there and put it into a new variable, in this case this person 2. So with that you look at this pointer structure and obtain the value from there, and that is the value that is then used here in our case for the call instruction. That is this person 2 is the thing that we have had in our data structure for struct A as this second component. So that is what we loaded with this load instruction to memory and into a variable, and which you could use then for an indirect branch. Instead of branching indirectly, I could also have used the symbol for the function directly if there is a direct call. In this case here, we have an indirect call, and thus we need to use a variable here. So instead, we could also have had something like f if there is a method f declared in our code. So that is kind of the maximum of complexity that's gonna be found in the examples. Of course, there might be a few other things in there, but I think if you happen to find something that you can't understand right now, then just just ask. Okay, if you are interested in getting your own insights into the whole thing, you can retrieve both the memory layout of a compilation unit as well as the actual intermediate representation code of your high-level file via certain command lines. So you can always just try to create your own examples for things that are interesting for you with those things. So the first line will get you a representation of the memory layout. pretty similar to the layouts that we will see on the next slide, just more textual representation. And the blue line will get you code pretty similar to the one that you've seen on this slide, just a little bit more hidden because it's embedded into a lot of prefix and postfix, and there's a lot of stuff happening around there in order to initialize libraries for C++ and do memory management all around that, and we're just going to focus on very selected parts of the whole thing. And as there's always the thing with LLVM and C++, it's an ever-evolving system, and what has been top-notch today might be already outdated tomorrow, and you probably won't be able to recreate exactly the same examples as you'll find on these slides with just rerunning the same thing, but just with a newer LLVM than I did. Yeah, the thing is that most approaches will yield equivalent results of some kind. There might be a few different data types or a few different paths that the compiler decides to generate for your thing. But the general concept should remain intact. It has been for the last 10 to 20 years, and yeah, that's kind of a standard thing. So it's not only LLVM that uses that kind of memory management, but also GCC. The Microsoft compilers do things a little bit differently. I don't know why, but yeah, they. I have a slide on what they do different later on. Yeah, it's just you can't. You can't actually see so well what's hidden in there, so that's why we focus more on these LLVM and GCC approaches. They are quite well documented in that respect. Okay, so how does memory management actually look like in the context of C++ object-oriented code? I always present you a box with high level on the left part, a box with an area with the data representation, one time graphical in the graphical representation, one time in the LLVM representation, and a box with the low level code of a selected fragment of a high level code in blue over there. So that's how you have to read these slides. So what we are going to look at is now a layout of classes where you have base class A and class B inheriting from class A, class C inheriting from class B. All of them implement particular methods, F, G, and H, different from each other, and they also carry properties or attributes with them, A, B, and C, conveniently named after the classes, and we're going to continue with that as long as that is somehow reasonable. So how do you organize memory for that? And yeah, that's what you, of course, see already provided here on that side. So if you need to represent something like the class A, well, thing is, the only thing that changes for each of the objects is, of course, the property part. So only those are actually gonna change throughout the lifetime of an object. Those things, the implementations of the methods, will, let's say, in our cases, just remain constant. So these are things that don't need to be part of the representation of each of the objects. So in the memory representations of objects in just that setting, you will only find counterparts for the attributes. So looking at the structs that are created, for example, for the class A, you will notice that there's one field of integer 32, which will correspond to this integer over here. Well, for my configuration, my architecture, the compiler chose I32. That might change depending on how the general settings on your systems actually are. Yeah, so that is everything that is needed for the representation of an object of class A. Then you might think about something like class B, which by itself defines a property B, but also has a relation with class A. And in the same spirit as you have this extends as a keyword in the Java world for inheriting from a parent, concept of extension also carries over to the actual representation in memory. So in order to get something like a class B representation, what is going to be done is we will have everything that we get from A and extend it by the field or the representation for the field B in there. And we're going to do or see the same thing happening for C. So we will have class C here, which will have everything that B had, just extended with a field for the property. Like that. And yeah. So the thing is, you start off with the parent and then extend the children around that. Another question is, is it pure random that I put my extensions, those things here, after I refer to my parent, or could I also have gone the other way, like putting my extensions in front? With yes, you mean it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. As long as we just look at the things that we have seen so far, I would decide similar. Let's have a look at why we do it this way. So that's why I put you an example of a short excerpt of how to work with that on there. So here we have a class C that starts living in variable C, and on this thing we now start calling method G with a parameter, and that's completely legal. We have a G here, and we find that by just checking inheritance relation and we find that there. What's going to be created as code for that is seen under there. So that's just the context. We generate a frame for the class, and then we essentially what we are going to do is we want to create generate a call expression. We exactly know what's called here. This is method G, which has been uniquely defined there. So we have one memory address that we can know and that we can write as constant in there and just refer to as with a constant name. And then we need to remember when we talked about this normalization of methods to functions by just pulling this receiver part back into the parameters. That's what happens also on the low level. We just see the receiver as just an additional first parameter. So that's what's going to go in here like that. And the first parameter is going here. So the question is now, let's keep that a little bit down that we had before. How do we actually implement the method itself? So let's have a look at how G could be implemented in there. So that G just can be fed with parameter, and what it may do is just add the parameter to the attribute. Remember this one here, or this one here. So the thing is now that we had issued the call to that thing on the representation of an object of type C. Remember? So that thing here, which had its nested collection of parents in there. So the representations for the A, B, and C were somewhat nested in there and came one after each other. So we start with all the attributes that make up A, then next in memory come the representations for B and the representations for C. So the thing is that issues of being efficient, we want to only generate code for methods or functions once, just for code size. So we don't want to have methods or implementations for methods G for the case that we have a C object, a B object, or even some arbitrary D or whatever. And the thing is now, we want to reuse just one method G. And this was specified with just an object representation of B in mind. So this assumes that we get a thing of type and thus also memory layout of a B object in there. So what we're going to do is we're going to interpret that as a pointer to B, thus dereference the pointer, and then navigate to the first slot in that thing, because in the memory representation we have the first slot for our attribute. The thing is now, if we would organize our classes such that we would prepend everything, our memory layout would grow to the front, so to the start of the object, thus shifting all the representations for the attributes or fields or properties of the ancestors more to the right or more distant from the start of the object representation. Thus, we couldn't have a constant difference in terms of addresses from the start of the object if you would prepend all these things. So in order to maintain an addressing scheme which just works with a constant, the idea is to just prepend extensions to the end of that thing in the sense of a list, because all that will be translated to plain pointer arithmetic in the sense that we will have these differences as they are always constant, just as an addition of a constant to the offset of the this to the start of the object as the this pointer. So in order to maintain that, the idea is to put the extending properties to the end of the representation. Okay, so we have the basic layout ideas with that fixed. So in memory, we will always find a representation for the C as for class C in that form. We can also interpret that as a B object by just looking at a prefix of the same thing. So casting between these objects is pretty simple. You don't have to change anything on the pointer. You can just interpret the same thing, but just ignore what else comes after. And you can even consider the prefix of that as of type A. So, yeah, you don't have to... Your cast operations are pretty cheap. They are just nops and can be thrown away. So casting only has a function on the type checker part and only on the compiling part, at least for now. So that is the principles of translating when we just have things like single inheritance. We don't have any multiple parents so far. And maybe that is one of the design choices that were out there for languages like Java or C# or any of the others that only have single inheritance. Casting is an easy process. You just reinterpret the prefix of your child as being a representation for the parent. So you don't have to do anything in terms of address computation. Next thing that we haven't looked at right now is managing polymorphic calls. So far, everything that we have seen has been statically dispatched and no runtime dispatching involved. How can you say that that was the case? Well, there hasn't been any virtual keyword in there, and C++ always has this virtual keyword to signify that these are components involved in dynamic dispatch. So, choices for implementing polymorphic calls or virtual dispatching in a single dispatching environment. There's several of those. You have seen one of the alternatives that you have in the last talk, where we had focused on how the Java interpreter, the runtime engine in its default version, interprets this invoke virtual instruction. And it can be compared to something like having a dispatch function that just searches the superchain for a correct implementation of something. So you have something like a runtime component involved in that. That is one version of how to do that. Then there's the people from the Hotspot community and just-in-time optimizations that have kicked Java to actually perform quite decently. by saying, well, these dispatchings, of course, are correct and work quite fine in practice. However, you always have to go through the complete hierarchy, but at least through parts of this superchain hierarchy. There's a lot of code involved and a lot of cycles of the CPU involved for that. Do we always have to do that? And they say, especially in these hotspots where we run through similar situations several times, and where we always come up with the same results of our computations, especially of the dispatch computations, we always have the same kinds of objects out there. Why should we always repeat those dispatch calls? Instead, the idea is to, at some point, when we have found that a spot is actually hot, in the sense that we see that they are repeated quite often, we would interfere with runtime and say, so let's do an optimization phase and replace the actual dispatching by something else. Mainly, we have found out via instrumentation that the dispatch always yields the same address of a function due to the objects on which we dispatch always having the same type. So what we do is we make sure that we don't do anything wrong by inserting an assertion that the object on which we have formally and which we have dispatched in the past actually have the same type as they had in the past, and then just insert the result that we have gotten all the time as a constant directly in there, and just refrain from trying to dispatch anything. Just assume that, well, if we have exactly that this particular type, we will always get the same answer, and thus, instead of doing doing this superchain run, and on the superchain run a binary search for the signature of a function, which is to a plain assert of the type information of the object representation that we find there, and then perform a direct call there, which is much cheaper than the dispatching. And that's one of the reasons why these hotspot or just-in-time compilers are so popular and so successful in practice. They save you a lot of time, especially in languages where, like Java, where essentially every call you issue is actually a virtual call, a runtime dispatch call. So, what else is there? In times where when something like a runtime system with a hotspot compiler was not a feasible solution, in the sense that it was just too costly to perform such an operation just in memory and live, and also in environments where just cannot just interrupt your program running, the idea was to actually do something similar, like not providing a cache, but a pre-computed result in the lookup table for the dispatching result that's going to happen for your run through the superchain hierarchy. And that led in the beginning of this polymorphic calls, or these virtual dispatchings, led to, well, a try with sort of conceptually a full two-dimensional matrix of all the signatures that are out there and all the classes that are out there, and entries in these matrix for all the concrete addresses of the methods where you would find their implementations. You can imagine that is quite unsatisfying in practical systems, so people quickly came up with other ideas for that. For example, the one-dimensional row displacement dispatch tables. Yeah, these were kind of ideas that would exploit the thing that large areas of the full two-dimensional matrices were actually not carrying any entries. So the idea would be to reuse the space that's there by just moving lines up and concatenating them, and just kind of say that at the offset 3, at offset 3, for example, we'd start with another dispatch line, creating something like the thing that you see down there, which is this one-dimensional row displacement dispatch table. For that, you would, of course, need to look up your actual displacement within this dispatching thing. Well, that has led to you can pre-compute something like that and just have a simple well, two lookups, one for the displacement and one for the actual value in there. And yeah, that works. You can even have quite efficient dispatch tables by even trying to compress that by making use of things like, well, you have, for example, here, well, let's maybe remove that. You have a free slot here and a free slot here, and they have a distance of just 2. And you have another line where you have an entry here and an entry here, and that's all that you need. They have a distance of 2, and they could fit in nicely in those parts. So that would be one way of compression. The other way would be, for example, to realize that for class A, you have the same entry as for class B, and class B just extends A with this one here, but you can overlap them and have shared entries because they're the same anyway. So you could have the same offset in the displacement dispatch table for both of them, essentially removing this and interpreting that like this, for example. So that's that has been an area of research for quite a long time. And then there's also the notion of virtual tables that are used within the LVM and the new C++ and a lot of other of these C++ realization, and that's what we're going to focus in this talk. So for virtual methods and method calls on that, we now have a little bit differences here. So we now have the keyword virtual in there. This designates that dispatching of method F, G, and H throughout the hierarchy is now interpreted as being virtual dispatching, even though those parts don't necessarily need to mention that once again. So it suffices to have that in the base class. By the way, it's for me, it's not about coding style or something here. It's just very condensed examples here. You would probably consider that as a bad idea to not mention the virtual here, but yeah, for me, it's I'm thinking more in this dimension as in this. So, yeah. Anyway, what you would do now is you now can't hard code, hardwire a concrete constant anymore in the actual call that you find over there. So, for this one over here, the actual dispatch target now depends on the history of how the reference C was actually created, and thus as we just translate one line after the other in our naive translation scheme, we can't hard code the correct value anymore, but instead we need to keep the whole thing indirect via some kind of variable. The question is now, how do we obtain the concrete target as a value for that? And as we have already seen, the idea is to put these kind of tables into action, where you have indices in these tables, and each of the indices or the value of the index is determining the signature that you want to actually on which you want to call, and depending on the actual identity of your object, what it actually is, it can place the correct reference or the correct address of the method to be called for that signature in that slot of the virtual table. And that's what you see here in our example. We now have that part of the object layout still remaining the same. It's just the places where the attributes are stored in the order that we have had so far. But as soon as we have virtual method resolution involved, we introduce another kind of implicit attribute, which acts as a pointer to the virtual table. So that's what this V pointer thing is. That's the pointer to the virtual table, and it points to another memory area, which is the same for all the C typed objects. So it's only there once in memory for all the C typed objects, and it has different slots associated, each of them associated with a particular signature, one for F with parameter integer, one for G with parameter integer, and one for H with parameter integer. And you have constants for each of them, which are the convention in there. And depending on what you actually want to call, you would navigate from the start of the virtual of the virtual table to the ith component of your function pointer table, and just load the value that you find there and interpret that as your call target. So how would that look like in practice? So let's have a look at how this one looks. And what we're going to do is we will have a look at C. And now there's an instruction that I haven't mentioned in the overview, but it's a bit cast. It's just there for the type system. It doesn't have any semantics. It just tells us how to interpret this identifier, and is to be interpreted as a pointer to a pointer to a pointer to a function. So, why is that? Well, that just is this hierarchy of C being, first of all, a pointer, and in there it has another pointer over there, which is pointing to pointers of functions. So that's why there's this three-level thing. That's how we interpret the C. So we reinterpret the first pointer with a different semantics there, but it's still the same value. So you can kind of forget about what it actually does. You just have to keep in mind that that is now the new type for the identifier over here. So that is now this server layer pointer, and we can then load this thing to create one level less of that. So with that, we would navigate into that thing. In there, we would then select the G entry, because that's the method that we want to call. In our case, it's the convention that that is supposed to be the, well, zero indexed first component of the thing, this one here. So we need to navigate to the first thing, load the content from there into three, and that is now the function address that we want to call. So that's what's going to go in there. And the other thing is that we have to give it a reference to B, but because that is a function that was declared in G. And yeah, in this case, we just reinterpret the same address with which we have started as being of type B. So we'll just reinterpret the same address. We can do that because, well, looking from a typecast point of view, the representation for C, if you just need a B, we can just look at, once again, just the B prefix, with this, which is this part, and everything would still remain compatible. We still have the virtual table pointer at the first element. This just stays the same for all these things that have a virtual table. And then if we have to interpret that as an A type, we can just put this one. And still, everything would hold. We would still find the correct entries for the methods that we have to call in case of virtual method resolution in there, because you would then, well, if you navigate through an object coming from the intention that it would be a B, you would just index from 0 to 1, for example, and just ignore that there's other things in there. So we have kind of the same layout in the virtual table as we have in the object representation, just reiterating this principle of starting with the base class's properties at the very start of my representation and extending always at the end. Okay. Good. So that thing about virtual methods. So how do we include several parent objects now? Good question. So the idea is now that we want to get something like this parent A and B for my class C. So that could look something like that. So we have class A and class B now, and C is now extending class A and B, or inheriting from class A and B. And apart from that, we have a similar situation as before, properties A, B, and C. And we now somehow have to decide on a way of layouting them. A and P for themselves don't have any references to each other, so there's just no connection or relation between those in any way. And that is also reflected in the representation of their fields. So we have class A with attribute A. We find that represented as a type with just one integer in there. We have a class B with attribute B, represented like this. And the question is now, what do we do with class C? This one has, of course, its own part, but it also somehow is associated with A and B. Question is now, how do we do that? And, well, pretty much similar to the way that we have done before, we would represent the extension at the very back and put our parents in front. But now we have to somehow decide which of them to put in front, because, well, it's kind of a linear scheme that we have here in our lists. We can't have something that is prioritized the same way, so we have to somehow come up with a layout for that. So we have, in this case, this class A and B like that. And that is now, well, kind of arbitrary. There's no real reason for one being in front of the other. It's just we have to come up with one way, and that's how we do that in the sense. So there's, without loss of generality, you can always say that one of those parents will be in front and the other one in the middle. That now can have certain consequences on the code that's actually created, especially if you consider something like casting. It's legal to do something like having an object of type C, which inherits from B, acting in places where you have pointers to an object of type of its parent. So that is something which needs to be legal. The question is now, if I continue on with my variable of type pointer to B, I might then decide to somehow access variable access property B from there. But in order to do so, my code needs, once again, this scheme of addressing my attributes with a constant offset from the pointer to the object. So in order to support that, we somehow need to do more than we are used to handling our pointers in cases of casts. What we need to do is we need to modify the pointer that we pass on to the whole thing, and that's what is also being reflected in the code part. So here we have this selection of the B offset within a C representation in our code. That's what's it's going to be achieved with a get element pointer on the representation of my created object with an offset of, in this case, it's 4. That has to do with the compiler deciding to translate the whole thing as a get element pointer on a pointer to 8-bit integers. So, yeah, that's one of the parts where that was just one of the things that I've obtained from the configuration that I had on my machine. It reinterprets the address that we have created so far as a pointer to integer of 8-bit, so on just single byte pointer. And it will go away. It will be it will navigate 4 slots to the right of that, which is just shifting 4 bytes, so to say, which will lead to on the raw memory surpassing the actual memory space that is needed for the A, which is 32 bits, which is actually 4 times the width of an i8, which will lead to the address computation to move from the start of the representation of a C 4 bytes to the right, which will move the pointer to the B's beginning. And thus, that is this delta B that I have marked here in the graphical representation of the memory for that. That delta B is the offset of B within the representation of C. And in case that I treat my object of type C as a B object by putting it into such a pointer to B, I need to actually perform a manipulation of my pointer. So implicit casts here potentially add a constant to the object pointer in the context of multiple inheritance if you happen to cast to your kind of to yeah, to this, that's the right part to mark to a variable of the type that has been chosen to be the one lying in the middle of your representation. In our case, the get element pointer implements delta B as 4 times the kind of the width of that thing. But yeah, it's realized like that. That might change on your run of the compiler. I don't know. I got it that way. Compiler decided that would be the most optimal way to do that. That might change in your implementation. Yeah, and with that, if you then do your call on G, G is the method that works on B. We now can't just simply has to happen each time. We can't just simply pass our original C reference in there anymore, but we now, of course, need to point to B, because remember, the way that the addressing scheme in G is implemented is that it supposes that its receiver parameter, or this parameter, is pointing to the start of the representation of a B object. So in that sense, we need to provide the receiver pointer through a computation that performs actually the modification of my offset within C. Whew. Okay. That's already quite nice. So the downside is now that when we start using multiple inheritance like that, we might buy ourselves situations like the one over here, where we have now two parents A and B, both of them offering exactly the same signature, and class C now trying to specialize both A and B. And yeah, now the question is, whenever we encounter something like F, what's actually meant with such a code? It should be mentioned that here's a point where different multiple inheritance systems actually differ in the way that they interpret these situations. There's solution one, which is the solution that languages like C++ or Java actually do. So you have explicit qualification in order to get rid of that. So you have to explicitly qualify which version of F you actually meant. Otherwise, a plain expression with just F won't compile. Okay, bailing out is always one solution. The other idea would be to do something more, kinda intelligent, in the sense that you do some kind of magical resolution stuff and come up with one call target that the user probably meant. Yeah, so the compiler introduces a linear order on the nodes of the inheritance graph. So it's just not a tree anymore, but it's a plain chain, which gives you the priority of the particular members of your inheritance tree. And with that, you can decide which of these things will actually be meant by such an ambiguous expression. In principle, there's now the part that deals with the different approaches for doing resolution of method calls in languages that do a linearization of their inheritance tree. However, we have reached the end of today's lecture already. Yeah, it's always this evaluation that always takes away time. So I think we will continue next time with that. And that will be also the last lecture before Christmas. Remember, this Friday there's no tutorial. Next Friday there will be, and I still hope that I can manage baking Stollen for you, so you will get a reward for coming on Friday, last day before Christmas Eve. Yay! With that, I hope, that I won't be completely alone in here. Also, I plan to move the tutorial not from this room to another, so we will meet actually in the second floor. That's where our chair is, and there's a seminar room with the number 2734. Think this one. I will also enter that into the TUM Online just for a kind of a pilot. I will just do it for this Friday, and if there, not this Friday, of course, Friday of next week. And if that is promising in terms of people attaining that, I think I will change the other dates also. So that's the situation for this and next week. Apart from that, I wish you a nice week, and we'll meet again next one. Thank you very much for your attention.